This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Morano. I've admired our next guest for some time, not only because he is a brilliant strategic mind, not only because he is a warrior, not only because he is a scholar, not only because he's able to take complex military and foreign policy issues and boil them down in a way that a dullard like me can understand, not only because when he speaks, he exudes such an authority you can't help but listen. It's not all, even because he's a decorated military veteran, having gotten things like the Bronze Star, the Meritorious Service Medal, the Army Commendation Medal, and a host of other really, really impressive commendations and medals of valor over the years. It's because he is one of only a handful of radio guests I've ever had that after he comes on, immediately after, people start calling and asking, when is he coming back? I am very, very pleased to welcome retired Army Colonel Douglas McGregor. He also served as a Pentagon official in the Trump administration and was actually nominated to be ambassador to Germany by President Trump, although that nomination didn't end up getting confirmed or even voted upon by the U.S. Senate. Colonel, it is great to talk with you again. Thank you for joining me on the radio.
Well, it's a pleasure. Thank you, Frank.
So let me begin with President Biden. We're at the 100-day mark. He gave his first joint, basically State of the Union, but his address to a joint session of Congress yesterday. He spent a little bit of time talking about Afghanistan. Give me your take on the president's plan to withdraw from Afghanistan by September 11th of this year.
Well, first of all, I think everyone should keep in mind that there's a lot of water under the bridge between now and 11 September. So whatever is being promised today, whether or not it will actually be fulfilled, is very much open to debate. But even more important, let's talk about what the president will not tell you. We know that even if we do withdraw the remaining uniformed 2,500 soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines who are still on the ground over in Kabul, there will still be 18,000 intelligence operatives, private contractors, including, frankly, mercenaries, people that are hired for security missions in Afghanistan, working effectively for the American government. And so I'm afraid people are missing the point that while the uniformed military personnel will leave, you'll still have this enormous presence. And it's obviously there to continue doing the things that they have been doing, which is not just to monitor terrorism, but also to use Afghanistan as a platform for operations of various kinds against Iran, Russia, China, and so forth. Also, it's important to keep in mind that there are over 400,000 Afghans, actually more Afghans working in the heroin industry in Afghanistan than there are in the Afghan security, police, and military forces. And they, of course, will still be very busy. And it's not hard to imagine that some of what they are doing with regard to heroin, since most of it, not all of it, but most of it is shipped into Eastern Europe, into Iran, Turkey, and into China, where it does enormous damage, obviously, is not also part of the plan. So I think that President Biden will sound lofty and convincing, but everyone should take a step back and understand that what he's promising is not really going to happen.
So, understanding what you said about intelligence officials, I watched during the Trump administration with a great deal of disappointment. Every time he would tweet something or make an announcement about withdrawing troops from anywhere, be it Afghanistan, Syria, anywhere, you'd essentially see the Pentagon and his own administration officials slow walk that withdrawal and do whatever they can to avoid the order. Understanding what you're saying, that President Biden's new policy is more of a withdrawal in name only, are you concerned that we may see the same thing in the Biden administration, that those forces of status quo that work within the Pentagon and within the government, that they may not even allow Joe Biden between now and September 11th to deliver on this pseudo promise?
Oh, absolutely. No question about it. And you're right. President Trump's greatest failing, if you want to point to it, is his failure to appoint people to key positions inside the White House, in his cabinet, and across the federal bureaucracy, hundreds of critical positions that really supported him and his agenda, who believed in it, whether it was border security and restricted immigration, an end to illegal immigration, fighting the drug trafficking and the illegal human trafficking that goes with it, or withdrawing forces from Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan, reducing our position overseas, particularly in a place like Germany where there's no real requirement for them, and reducing ultimately our position in South Korea. All of those things were on his agenda. And in the last year when he was there and when he spoke to me, it was very clear that he intended to have a very different slate if he were reelected. And unfortunately, that didn't happen, and we'll never know what would have actually occurred. But I think we would have seen a more successful and a more effective second term.
There's been some talk and there's been some news coverage. And to your point, I was saying, and I'm a Trump supporter, and I was saying during the first 2-3 years of his administration is the biggest problem with the Trump administration is that there were no Trump supporters in it. And I thought it was a real problem when you have people like Lindsey Graham defending President Trump on foreign policy issues, given the fact that President Trump campaigned on sort of the opposite of the foreign policy that people like Lindsey Graham and others were advocating for years. But there was an article in NPR yesterday that indicated that the U.S.'s unconditional withdrawal from Afghanistan would be rattling the already shaky peace talks that are ongoing between the Afghan government and the Taliban. Do you see that as a problem?
I would not expect the Taliban, people who are Sunni Islamists, Muslims who are Sunni Islamists, are under no obligation to tell the truth to anyone who is not an Islamist like themselves. In other words, if you're not a Sunni Muslim, then frankly speaking, they can tell you anything they want. It doesn't make any difference. They can do anything they want to you, and they are justified. So I've never attached any significance to any sort of withdrawal agreement whatsoever. The problem is, I think everyone has been looking unnecessarily, not President Trump when he was in office, but certainly everyone else, for some sort of fig leaf of legitimacy, some kind of cover that would provide them with political comfort so that the American people would not rise up and say, well, what are we doing there and how much money have we spent and how many thousands of Americans have been killed or wounded and what did we accomplish? And of course, the answer is we know. Nothing of strategic value to the American people. And the other part of this that we can't lose sight of is the enormous amount of money that's been spent. We now think of almost $1 trillion has been lost in Afghanistan. Well, when we say it was lost, well, where did it go? We have highways, buildings, hospitals, you name it, that were never built, that were obviously paid for. Well, it's very obvious. The place is a sea of corruption, and that corruption, unfortunately, touches us. And a lot of that money has disappeared into the pockets of all sorts of contractors in the United States as well as overseas. So the point is, no one really wants to discuss any of it. No one wants to bring it up. So they were looking for some reason to get out. Well, we have an agreement with the Taliban. It's absurd and totally meaningless.
So let's talk about the situation at the border. You were somebody, even during the Trump administration, that was talking about the problem at the border and using the American military to actually back up the border patrol and prevent further border incursions. This problem has been magnified manyfold under the Biden administration. How do you see the problem there, and where do you see it going? Are you at all optimistic that the administration has anything resembling a handle on this?
Oh, I think they've got control of it. There's no question about it, but their idea of control is to bring in as many people as they possibly can, as quickly as possible, from anywhere in the world, frankly, but preferably from Latin America, the Middle East, Africa, some portions of Asia, but not many. But the idea is that they have to bring in as many non-Europeans as possible in order to outnumber the numbers of Americans of European ancestry who live in the United States. That's what it's all about. And I don't think there's any point in questioning it. That is the policy. And our officers on the border, the Border Patrol, are frustrated beyond imagination. And health officials in Health and Human Services are horrified because there is no effort being made whatsoever to establish the quality of health in these people. So we're bringing in large numbers of people we know have COVID, but many of them have other diseases as well. Remember, as soon as you're south of the border, you're in Mexico, you're back in a developing country. They have bubonic plague and a number of different diseases that are still active in that country that we've long since eradicated from the United States. So unfortunately, no. There's no reason for optimism, and I think we're going to be flooded with large numbers of additional criminals in addition to those that we're releasing in our big cities all over the country.
So you believe the administration's handling of the border crisis is not a result of incompetence. It's not a result of weakness. It's not a result of an unwillingness to do what needs to be done. You believe this is actually strategic on the part of the Biden administration and very intentional.
Oh, absolutely. This is a deliberate policy to enact demographic change. And of course, all of these things are taking place without ever consulting the American people on whether or not this is something that they support, because they know that if there were a plebiscite, everyone would vote against it. So they've done everything up until this point through the courts. Now these things are being done with executive orders. And I think the American people are going to wake up and find that we're flooded with a large numbers of people that, frankly, we didn't ask for, we don't want, and many of them will be more than simply a burden on our economy. We'll have a lot of criminals on our hands, and we're going to see the drug trafficking increase by leaps and bounds if it hasn't already. You know, somebody said to me the other day, you want to leave Afghanistan, but look, if we leave, people are going to be killed. I said, if you go back to 2015, 2016, each of those years, we had more than 40,000 Americans die from opioid overdose. That's far more than have died in Syria, Iraq, or Afghanistan in recent years. We think that last year, maybe as many as 47, 48, 49,000. That doesn't even begin to address the criminality beyond the drug abuse that we're dealing with in our cities. And your listeners are well aware of what's going on. Just as we're defunding the police and driving good men and women out of the police forces, we're also encouraging all these worst elements to come in and camp and effectively enjoy the fruits of citizenship without earning them and without ever having qualified for them. And I think some of you must have seen the thousands of pregnant women coming up from Latin America so they can have their children here, and then the child immediately is declared an American citizen. And again, all of this is part of the grand plan. This is what Mr. Biden and his supporters want. They want another country. They don't want the United States.
We're talking with Colonel Douglas McGregor, retired U.S. Army colonel, author. His work has been recommended and required reading, not only at the top echelons of the American military, but the Israeli government and the Israeli military as well. He's also a former assistant to the Secretary of Defense in the Trump administration. He was also nominated by President Trump to be ambassador to Germany. Colonel, one of the areas that I'm so frustrated with there being bipartisan consensus in Washington on is how to handle Russia and Eastern Europe. The one thing Democrats and Republicans both seem to agree upon is that Putin is evil, Russia is the bad guy, and we need to treat them that way no matter what. You had a phenomenal piece in the American Conservative, and I'm going to link to it on my Facebook page, and I hope people read it at facebook.com/MoranoFan, in which you talk about the Ukraine crisis being a tremendous opportunity for the United States and for Russia. Tell me where the opportunity lies with respect to this Ukraine crisis.
I think if we are willing to look at Ukraine through a different lens, through the lens of Eastern Europe and through the lens that Russia sees Ukraine, and we begin to understand Russian national security interests, which are legitimate in that part of the world. We're not talking about Russian national security interests in the United States or Canada or France or the Mediterranean or North Africa. We're talking about Russian national security interests on their doorstep. And if we're willing to do that, I think there really is an opportunity to forge a different solution. In other words, to come up with something that, first of all, avoids an unnecessary war. And the last thing Ukraine needs is another war. The millions and millions of human beings who died in Ukraine right after World War I, straight through until the end of the Second World War, are phenomenal numbers. We're talking 20, 30, 40 million human beings that lost their lives there thanks to Soviet communism and the war between Nazism and communism. We don't need to go down that path again. And if there is a war in Ukraine, it will be a very bloody and destructive affair that will eventually spread to the rest of Eastern Europe, and we don't want to do that. There is an opportunity, but we have to understand that just as we look at Mexico as a place where who governs in that country and who lives in that country and who has forces in that country matters to us, the Russians look at Ukraine with the same viewpoint in mind. They don't want foreign forces on Ukrainian soil. They don't want foreign bases in Ukraine from which attacks could be projected against Russia. They don't want a potentially destabilizing influence in Kiev that could harm Russian national security and internal societal stability. We have been unwilling to accept those as legitimate interests. And if we're willing to do that, I think we can come to an arrangement whereby Ukraine does not become a member of NATO, which is completely unnecessary and counterproductive. It could become a neutral state on the Austrian model. And then we need to take a really hard look at Ukraine itself. Once you move into certain areas, whether it's Crimea, these provinces east of the Dnieper River, and the fringe of Ukraine down along the coast towards Odessa, you discover the people that live there are Russians. You can't wish them away. They are Russians. And originally there was a provision that said Russians would be respected as citizens of Ukraine. They could practice their version of Orthodox Christianity, speak their language, and so forth. And that hasn't really turned out to be the case. So it may be time to adjust the borders of Ukraine to ensure that we don't have these unnecessary conflicts inside Ukraine.
And, you know, you talk about Joe Biden, who reached out to the Ukrainian President Vladimir Zelensky, promising to preserve the territorial integrity of Ukraine, including Crimea, never mind the fact that Crimea was part of Russia from the time of Catherine the Great to the time of Joseph Stalin. I really haven't heard much of an outcry, not to say that Russia is great with allowing the free flow of information from its citizens. I really haven't heard much of an outcry from the ethnic Russians that live in Crimea, which is the majority, who want to be part of a country other than Russia. So who is President Biden willing to make this effort for? It certainly doesn't seem as if it's for the people in Crimea.
No, it doesn't make a great deal of sense. President Trump understood two things. He understood that, first of all, whenever we can, however we can do it, we should avoid war. And now I know that sounds simple, but it's true. President Trump was very opposed to war. He was not opposed to maintaining a strong and powerful and influential military establishment, but he wanted to think very carefully about the use of military power because of the disaster we've had for the last 20 years. Some people would say almost 30. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that President Trump was always interested in coming to an arrangement that would provide some long-term measure of stability. Now, as you point out, you know, the borders in that part of the world have changed dozens of times over the last several hundred years. But we need some stability. We need it for economic prosperity. We need it for trade. And he was always very focused on that. So the idea of going to war over Ukraine was simply outrageous to him. And if he were still president, I think what he would have said to Zelensky is that we support you, but we do not support a resolution of this crisis or conflict with the use of military power, because he understood very well that it didn't matter what we give the Ukrainians, given the fact that they're sitting on Russia's doorstep, the Russians can crush them. He also understood that if we have to fight the Russians, the last place you want to do it is on Russia's doorstep. You know, why would you fight them there, for God's sake? So these are basic understandings that are completely absent from the Biden administration. They don't care. They're caught up in I would call, a world of wishful thinking rooted in impossible ideology.
Now, and we're talking with Colonel Douglas McGregor. He's an author, retired Army colonel. Everything you just said about the Russia situation makes perfect sense to me. And I don't think you have to be conservative or liberal or any ideology to see the logic in everything that you just said. And yet, when you say what you just said, that is a minority view in the punditocracy. You watch Fox News, MSNBC, CNN, you hear very few voices that articulate what you just said. Instead, we hear the prevailing wisdom that Vladimir Putin is a dictator, hell-bent on reforming the Soviet Union, and he needs to be stopped at all costs. How did that, that Russia is evil narrative, become the prevailing view in the media? It wasn't even that way during the Cold War with the Soviet Union.
No, I think you're right. The first is to go back and recall that in 2003, large numbers of people in government, on the Hill, in the White House, in Department of Defense, in the State Department, all insisted that Iraq was on the verge of building and potentially detonating a nuclear weapon. Remember the mushroom cloud comments and so forth. And that Saddam Hussein was absolutely hell-bent and determined to destroy Israel, and that whatever happened, a nuclear weapon would end up being launched against Israel. There was no counter to any of it. There was no debate. There was no discussion. The media and everyone in government picked up on it. We're in that kind of environment now on steroids. And remember that money really speaks in Washington. You have to go through and look at the people who donate money to key members of the Senate and in the various political parties. And the people that are donating money have interests, and those interests do not necessarily align with the American people. So the biggest problem is that the interest of the average American is absolutely not represented in Washington. I mean, Frank, if you and I went out to St. Louis or Seattle or, you know, Colorado Springs, Casper, Wyoming, or New Orleans and asked people, what about NATO? What do you think we should do? What if there's a war in Ukraine? Should we fight it or something? They'd all look at you and say, right. First of all, who cares?
Right. Yeah. I don't know
where it is. What are you talking about? And I don't care. You can't build a policy on that foundation.
Colonel, believe me, I know, especially after a President Biden speech, there's nothing you probably want to do more now than go to bed. So I will let you go. And I'm cognizant of the fact that I've kept you as long as I have. This is the final thing I want to ask you about on the Russia question, though. A couple of weeks ago, I was interviewing General Wesley Clark, a four-star general, former head of NATO. And I asked him basically all of if he could understand why Russia would be a little irked about the eastward expansion of NATO. This is a little bit of his response.
Can you understand a little bit of Russia's frustration in seeing NATO expand right up to its border? And can you understand why Russia might be looking to do some saber rattling and blustering in response to that?
No, it's absolutely not understandable. And I'll tell you why. There's no way in which NATO would ever threaten Russia. NATO cannot attack. NATO has no attack capabilities, never has had. This is maybe Russia trying to make you see their point of view, but their point of view is not defensible. Their point of view is imperialistic, assertive, aggressive, and offensive. Russia has a four century long record of overrunning other people. Russia wants everything. It wants a buffer zone in Eastern Europe. Oh, but it would like more assurance that Germany and France would be friendly. Russia's insecurities cannot be allowed to create insecurity for the rest of the world. So the fact is, Russia should concentrate on working for the Russian people and not be so concerned about repressing the Belarusian people, which they're doing right now, or threatening the Ukrainian people, or challenging the nationhood of the Baltic states, or threatening the United States if we send a couple of destroyers into the Black Sea. That's not the right role for Russia. It's not understandable, and we should not say we understand it.
Your reaction to what General Clark said there?
Russia was adamantly opposed to the intervention with air power against Serbia, that is Yugoslavia, in 1998 and 99. And we disregarded their views and their interests. And Russia has a long-standing relationship with the Serbs and was very disturbed at what was ostensibly a bombing campaign designed to achieve regime change in Belgrade. The Russians have watched attempts at regime change that we have undertaken all over the world, most recently in Ukraine itself with the color revolution. They've witnessed a recent attempt in Belorussia. So Russians have reason for insecurity because they see a concerted effort in the West led by us to infiltrate, to expand, and ultimately to bring down their regime and change their society. The Russians don't want that. And then finally, we can go all the way back to the discussions and the verbal agreements that were made between the Russians and Americans. This happened while President Bush was in office. It was reaffirmed under our friend Clinton when he was president. And we said, no, we will not expand the borders of NATO. We will not bring in all these other states. And we've gone against all of that. And we now have forces right on the border with White Russia and Ukraine. And we have moved into Ukraine with advisors and assistance and weaponry. So we've gone back on every promise that we've made. And frankly, I would take the opposite position. I'm astonished at how much restraint Putin has exercised because he really doesn't want a war with anybody. And he has actually contributed enormously to ending a lot of conflict, most recently in the Caucasus, which could have brought the Turks into war against Armenia and eventually into a major war with Russia. He's not interested in going to war, but if he's pushed on this issue, if we insist on staying the course and threatening Russia, punishing Russia with these sanctions unnecessarily, now we're going to push them out of the SWIFT system, try to isolate them financially, then I think we could see the Russians strike back when we least expect it. Just imagine, what would we do if a Russian flotilla of two or three or four warships sailed into the Caribbean? We conduct exercises routinely in the Baltic Sea and off the coast in the Arctic, right within a stone's throw of Russia, within 50 nautical miles of St. Petersburg. And we launch cruise missiles, we launch aircraft, and we cooperate with our allies. And the Russians are furious. Why are you doing this? What would happen if those things were done by the Russians right off the coast of Boston? What's to stop them from sailing into Long Island Sound? What's to stop any of them from executing these kinds of missions off the coast of the northwestern United States? So I think he's taking a very one-sided view that sounds very rooted in the 30-year-ago Cold War as opposed to now. Things have changed. Russia is not the Soviet Union. It's actually much smaller. It has a much smaller economy, smaller armed forces, and is very regionally focused, not globally focused as we are. So I don't agree with General Clark, but then again, I didn't agree with the Kosovo air campaign when he conducted it, but I was on active duty, kept my mouth shut, and executed, except for the times when I spoke privately about my concerns with it.
Colonel, I appreciate your time. One day we'll have to do a whole hour together. The time just flies by when I speak with you. I appreciate the insight and the time.
Okay. Thank you very much, Frank. My best to everybody.
Thank you. If you want to comment on any portion of my discussion with Colonel Douglas McGregor, you can give me a call, 1-800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. This is The Other Side of Midnight. Straight ahead.